Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
I'm Dave Gagan, host of the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'd like to welcome you to today's show, Science and Consciousness. Do you ever wonder why science doesn't think there's a spiritual world? Well, that's the focus of today's show. We have a very special guest with us this morning. Peter Russell is what I call a technical guy seeking truth. Mr. Russell is on the faculty of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and a fellow at the World Business Academy and the Feinhorn Foundation. He studied mathematics and theoretical physicist at Cambridge University under Stephen Hawking, the legendary physicist. He then became fascinated by the mysteries of the human mind and changed his focus to experimental psychology. After graduation, he traveled to India and studied meditation and Eastern philosophy. He is the author of The Global Brain, plus numerous other books. As one of the more revolutionary futurists, Peter Russell has been a keynote speaker at many international conferences in Europe, Japan, and the United States. His principal interest is the deeper spiritual significance of the times we are passing through, and his work seeks to understand the essence of the world's spiritual traditions. It's a treat for me to have Peter Russell with us today, and I'd like to welcome you to our show.
Thank you, David. It's nice to be with you.
Let's start out by talking about paradigms. Now, a paradigm is simply the underlying assumptions of a given theory of or view.
Yeah.
Now you have said that science's paradigm, which states that space, time, and matter are all that is required to understand and analyze the world, is wrong. What do you mean by that?
It's not wrong. It's not complete. I mean, clearly everything we know about space, time, matter, energy holds up. So there's nothing wrong with that. But it's incomplete because it doesn't account for the fact that we are conscious experiencing beings. I mean, you know, right now, I'm having an experience, you're having an experience, the listener is, you know, seeing where they are, they're hearing this my voice. We are experiencing beings, and that's probably the one thing we cannot doubt. And yet it's the one thing that science cannot explain. It can explain so much about the physical universe, but it doesn't account for the fact that we actually have this inner world of experience. According to science, we all should be sort of biological robots doing our thing, eating, you know, walking, doing what we do. Why do we have an experience? And so this is where I think that the current paradigm is missing something. So it's not that it's wrong, it's just it's not yet complete because it doesn't include consciousness within it. The one thing we cannot deny, and this is a true anomaly for it. When you have something you cannot deny and cannot explain, then there's something amiss with the paradigm.
Yeah, exactly. Why do you think science has ignored consciousness?
I think for several reasons. I mean, if we go back historically, sort of science really, sort of the seeds of science go back 300 years or so to Descartes, when he started calling his studies natural philosophy. And he said, you know, we will study the natural world, but the world of the mind will leave to the church. Because in those days, if you trampled on the church's ideas, you were likely to get burnt at the stake or something. So that was often called the Cartesian split. He said, you know, we'll deal with matter, let the church deal with affairs of the mind. And that sort of, that's been there all through history, the last few hundred years. But I think more important than that is science cannot measure consciousness. It can measure brain activity, but it can't measure our actual experience. It's not something to be weighed or you put a ruler against. And so science doesn't know how to handle it. And in terms of the physical world, there seems to be no need to understand it. I mean, we can understand everything that's going on, you know, in the world of matter, down to atoms, out to galaxies. We can understand all of that without needing to understand consciousness. And so I think science has taken the attitude, well, you know, our model works fine. We don't need to bother ourselves with this rather troubling subject of personal experience.
Yeah, well, what do you think consciousness is? You know, it's you know, everybody uses the term, and but what do you think it is?
Well, I think even that question really actually takes us off on the wrong track. I think as soon as we use the noun consciousness, we make it a thing. You know, you say, what is it? And we assume it is something, some phenomena. And when we add N-E-S-S to any word, we take a quality, an adjective, and we turn it into an abstract noun to talk about it. So, you know, we might talk about happiness, but there's no such thing as happiness. But you can talk about being happy, and you can, you know, measure that. But happiness itself doesn't exist. It's just an abstract noun. And it's the same with consciousness. What really exists is the fact that we are experiencing beings. And so I think it's actually better to talk about what does it mean to be conscious rather than say what is consciousness. I think that's where science, when it does look at consciousness, it gets itself off on the wrong foot, because it's looking for something out there almost in the world and not recognizing that what we're really referring to is the fact that we are aware of the world. And so we have our own the fact that we are aware, looking out there for something we call a consciousness, not recognizing what we're really pointing to is ourselves and the very fact we're aware.
Okay, so that's a good way to put it. So you're looking at it as a being, right now, as being aware of ourselves and the environment around us, I guess.
Yes, and you could say that everything we experience is something, I mean, again, using the word loosely here, something that happens in our consciousness. And it's our whole environment, all the senses, what I see, hear, smell, touch, taste, what I feel inside my body, what I think, my emotions, all of that is appearing in our mind, appearing in our consciousness. And so it's that without which there wouldn't be any experience at all.
Yeah. Do you think science is changing its view as far as recognizing the conscious being or consciousness or what?
It is slowly. And it's not that science as a whole is changing, but you're finding an increasing number of individuals who are beginning to change their view about what it means to be conscious. And that's beginning to happen. So the signs are there. And I think also there's a growing realization that there is something limited about the current paradigm, because it cannot explain the fact that we are conscious. Mm-hmm. And I think this comes from two areas. One, in theoretical physics, quantum physics, we've come to realize that the observer somehow plays a role. We don't know quite how, but it seems that the fact that a system is observed is somehow important. And then along with this, in more recent years, all the research that's going on in the brain, in neurophysiology, is clearly related to, you know, what is happening in our conscious awareness. So I think these two things together are pushing scientists to say, you know, we need to begin to really see if we can understand this troubling subject.
Yeah. You know, mankind certainly is aware or conscious of its environment, and I think most people would say that the other higher level animals are as well, but lower level animals, you know, they'll move when there's heat on them or light or vibrations and other stimuli, and even plants respond to environmental stimuli, you know, like light and such. Yeah. But some people, you know, have even done studies which say that plants respond better to a loving and nurturing attention versus a harsh treatment. How far down do you the chain do you think the conscious world?
Yes. Well, I think there's two questions here, really. In terms of, you know, how far down the chain does, you know, being aware go? I think it goes all the way down, and I say that because there's nowhere you can really draw a line. There's something in philosophy which is called the hard problem of consciousness. And the hard problem is, how is it that what we call, you know, unconscious matter, our nerve cells, the chemistry of the brain, which we assume is not conscious, how on earth does that give rise to experience? And no one's answered that question. But if you say, as we go down the evolutionary tree, if we say suddenly consciousness appears, you know, we accept our pets are conscious. I mean, I sometimes say, when people say, oh, a dog isn't conscious, I would retort, well, why would we give it an anesthetic if we didn't think it was conscious? Clearly we think it would feel pain. We imagine it has experience, it would feel pain. You know, we accept our other animals are conscious. You know, we accept probably fish are conscious. You know, we wouldn't want to deliberately hurt a fish or something. So as we go down the tree, there's nowhere we can easily draw the line, because as soon as you draw a line, I mean, supposing you said, you know, fish were conscious, but let's see what's below fish, say something like snails aren't. You have to explain, what is it about a fish's nervous system that allows unconscious matter to become aware, which doesn't happen below it in a snail? The hard problem keeps coming up wherever you draw the line. So I think as we go down the evolutionary tree, it isn't that other creatures have the same capacity as we have, because we have, you know, we not only are observing the world, we have feelings, we have emotions, we have all these other faculties. And we have self-awareness. I don't think a dog has self-awareness, for example. I don't think it sits there thinking, oh, you know, I'm a being, I'm conscious, isn't this interesting? But it still is aware, and I think other animals certainly have feelings. So as we go down the evolutionary tree, we find there's less and less happening in the consciousness. So, you know, I would say a plant has a very rudimentary awareness, very, very simple awareness. Whether or not that can pick up, you know, the intentions of people, I don't know. I mean, I've come across some of those experiments. Whether they hold up or not, to be honest, I really don't know.
Yeah, but they certainly are interesting,
but my view is we can't draw the line anywhere. That even a simple cell, a simple bacterium, is having its tiny, tiny, tiny glimmer of awareness. It's maybe just a very faint sensing of the environment. And so probably any organism, its very first glimmer of awareness is just that sensing of the environment. I think that's the beginning of being conscious.
Yeah. Let me just read this to you, and I want your reaction to it.
Okay.
Okay. There's an occult traditions which say that we start out as a spiritual essence, a group spirit, and are sent into the universe to learn. And we start out as minerals, where we simply exist, then evolve into vegetation, such that we can experience growth, then into lower animal forms, where we experience movement. But it is only in the higher animal levels where our spirits individualize. And eventually we develop a mind where we can gain wisdom, and the spirit can then incarnate into human form. Once we attain wisdom, we return to the spiritual realm, where we continue to evolve forever into higher level spiritual beings. So essentially, we begin our existence in the spiritual realm as a spiritual essence, and after a great deal of effort, return to the spiritual realm as an individualized spirit, but still remain part of the group consciousness. What do you think of that?
I have difficulties imagining when it says we. I have difficulty imagining we, I, being, you know, a rock, you know, starting out at that level. So as it's worded, I find that a difficult thing to understand. I mean, I see that, you know, evolution as a whole, life as a whole, has evolved through, you know, starting off with the mineral kingdom, moving through plants into animals. I see the evolution of life as a whole has done that. I don't know about, you know, I can't relate to the idea of my individual spirit having done that. That doesn't quite make sense to me. I don't quite understand that.
Yeah. It's an interesting concept. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's certainly you know, it would explain to a certain extent how, you know, how we evolve and how we come about and how all of a sudden we appear as a human. And if the lower life forms were conscious, you know, where are they going to go? Are they going to come up and be human? Were we lower life forms at one time?
Well, this gets into the whole, you know, question of reincarnation and things, which
exactly,
which I know nothing about. I mean, I have enough problems incarnating in this life, living this life. But I think this, I mean, my view is in this life, you know, who knows what's behind it all. The important thing is how do we evolve as individuals in this life. That's where, you know, that's where the rubber hits the road in terms of our development, is right here now in this life. And that's all I really know from experience. There's many ideas around about what happens before or afterwards, but in the end it's what am I doing in this life? How can I open up my consciousness more? How can I become a, you know, more loving human being here and now? That to me is the question.
You don't look at us as eternal beings having a life experience, if you will.
I look at not beings. I mean, I'm going to be particular with words here. I look at us as eternal consciousness having a human experience.
Okay.
But not as individual being. To me, you know, there is consciousness is just the fundamental essence of all beings. There's that fundamental essence of being aware, or just of knowing experience. It's what we sometimes call, you know, that sense of I-ness, of I knowing experience. I think that knowingness of experience is there in all creatures. And in human beings, that knowingness is having the knowing of a human experience, which is, you know, seeing the world through human senses, having human thoughts, human feelings. So that is the form which consciousness is taking on in me. In a dog, it's taking on a different form. But I see that as like, well, a good analogy is like you take, you know, water. Take drops of water from an ocean. You can put water in one bucket and it has, you know, it's the experience of that bucket, and put it in a different container in a cup. It's like it's having a cup experience. It's all just water in essence, but it isn't that one bit of water goes from a cup to a bucket or whatever. It's just that's the form that the essence, the universal essence, is taking.
So you see your consciousness going on, but, well, not your ego, probably, that you're not the I, but the general consciousness going somewhere eternal.
Well, not my consciousness, because I mean it isn't my consciousness. I mean there is consciousness which takes on the shape of me, the shape of me-ness, takes on the shape of I-ness. So it's like water taking on the shape of a bucket. It takes on that shape, but when the bucket goes, I think it just dissolves back into the ocean.
Okay. Life's purpose. What would our purpose be here? Do we have a purpose?
That's a difficult question to answer, because you probably find there's 7 billion different versions of that answer on the planet. I think purpose, in a sense, is something we decide for ourselves. I'm not sure there's, you know, universal purpose that, you know, everybody can agree to. It would be very dangerous for me to say this is the purpose of life. Me, just one of numerous human beings. Other people may come up with a different conclusion. But I think for me, I purpose is an individual thing, what we make of life. For me, the purpose, I see the purpose as to become more aware, to become more conscious, to begin to know our true self, our true nature more and more clearly. I would see that as the purpose of life, of my life at least.
Do we gain something from having more awareness? Are we improving? Do we start out with a certain awareness and then And then as we go through life, we increase what they gave us in, or I assume somebody gave it to us in a way of awareness. And then when we leave it, it's improved some way. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yes, I'm not sure I don't know about being given something, but I think we all seek to, in some way or another, to improve ourselves, to improve our conditions, to become better human beings. So I think that's a natural tendency, and part of that, I think, is opening up our awareness. I think we are very caught in our culture in what I call a materialistic awareness, where we are caught in the belief that whether or not we're happy depends upon what we have, what we do, depends upon our circumstances. And I think one of the universal themes behind all spiritual traditions is saying that's a trap, that when we do that, we actually start misusing or abusing other people and the environment. We lose touch with our sort of innate sense of love. We're not really behaving in an appropriate manner. But when we can discover our true self, then we find there the peace, the happiness that we're looking for out there. And when we do that, then we can start being free from that materialistic conditioning and begin to live, I would say, happier and healthier lives.
So you would see really maybe our purpose in life is to live more happily, more contentedly, more at peace with ourselves?
Yes, not in a hedonistic way. Not as our purpose is just, you know, to find, to be happy and, you know, who cares for anything else. I would say our purpose is to discover our true nature. And when we do that, then we find we are living in a much more contented, loving state. That comes as a result of it, as a result of opening our awareness.
Yeah, okay.
So there's a subtle distinction there. It's not that the purpose is to be happy. It's like being happy is the consequence of achieving our purpose.
Okay. Do we aspire to be something greater than we are, you think?
Yes, I think that's really what we're saying. I think we aspire to be all that we can truly be. I think that's what we aspire to be, is all that we can truly be as human beings.
Do you think that's innate within us?
I think it is. It doesn't always, I mean, it's not that everybody is going to manifest that in their lives, but I think it is innate in all of us. Yes, I think it is innate in all of us.
Okay. How about contentment? You know, when I look across the world of mankind, you know, I would say that mankind is not content. You know, and that's not individual, but I'd say in general, if you go to talk to people, most people, I would say, were not in, you know, content.
Yes. And now
the question is, why is that? Do you think that we're not content because we're confused by the environment that we've been thrown in? Or do you think there's something inside us that says you need to, I don't know, aspire to something? You need to do more.
Right. This is, I think, a really important question. I totally agree, is that we are not content. Most people are not content. Contentment, I think, is what we are seeking. Ultimately, we're seeking to be content. And that I think, is completely natural, because if for any animal, not just human beings, any animal, if you're well fed, you know, you're comfortable temperature, there's no danger, you're going to feel okay. You're going to feel content. So I think feeling content is the natural counterpart of our world being okay, of feeling safe in the world, and no danger, our needs are fulfilled. We feel content. It's completely natural. So then the question is, you know, why are we so discontent? Because you could argue that because of all the technology and comforts we have, all the commodities we have, we should be much more content than any other animal. You know, and yet if I look at a dog, it seems to be content much more than me. It's got nothing to do, it'll just lie with its head on the ground watching the world go round. It doesn't start getting up and saying, hey, I'm bored, I want to do this, can I watch television or something? I think we create discontent for ourselves, and this to me is what's interesting. And I think we do this because our culture is continually feeding us with the idea that if we're not happy, if we're not content, we need to do something. There's something missing in our life, and we need to do something. And so our culture keeps us focused on looking out there, getting things, doing things, having people behave the right way towards us. We're looking for contentment continually out there in the world around us, rather than recognizing it is the natural state of consciousness. And so paradoxically, it's our seeking contentment in the world makes us create discontent because we don't find it. And if we weren't actually, if we could stop that seeking and just let the mind relax, we would drop back into the natural state of contentment. And I think one of the things I find fascinating about the internet, how it shows this up in a strange way with internet shopping, you know, if we go and, you know, normally you go and buy something, you buy a new jacket or something in a store, and you buy the jacket and you feel content, you feel happy again. You think it's the buying of the jacket that's made you content. Now with the internet, the actual buying and the getting it are separated. You know, you do all your research on the internet, you find what you want, you make sure it's the right color, the right size and everything, and then you press, you know, pay now.
Right.
That's the moment you feel content. Maybe three days later before it arrives, and who knows whether you're content or not when it arrives. It may not be the right color you thought it was or something. But that moment you hit buy now, or pay now, you have stopped creating discontent. You had a little discontent created because there was something you didn't have. When you hit buy now, it's like, ah, that's coming. And so I think this is showing us how we actually create discontent for ourselves. And advertising is doing this the whole time. Just about every single advertisement you see,
it's saying
you cannot be content as you are. There's something you're missing. You cannot be content as you are. And it's almost like making us discontent and saying you have to buy this product, whatever it is, in order to feel happy. So our whole culture is actually geared up to making us feel discontent. And I think that's the root of the problem.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's, you know, it's kind of like a chicken or an egg. Is our discontent causing the culture to be this way, or is the culture causing our discontent to be this way? And your argument is, you think it's the culture that's driving the discontent.
I think the culture is driving it and making it much, much, much worse. I mean, if you look at very simple cultures where people are living very simple lives, like, you know, go to indigenous cultures, you find those people are much, much more content, probably very content with what they have. So I think the natural state of the human being is one of contentment most of the time. But when there's something that's not right, when there's something missing or some danger, then you move temporarily into discontent in order to do something about it, go and get some food, put on some warmer clothes, whatever it is. But then you should return to contentment. Whereas what we do in our culture is we stay in discontent. But I say, if you look at simpler cultures, or, you know, I think we probably all know people who, you know, may have very little in the way of material things, but are actually content with what they have.
Yeah, I think you're right. I've heard you speak about contentment and love. Now, we've talked about contentment. We haven't talked about love. What's your view of mankind's need for love?
Ah, this is also another big topic. We use the word love in different ways. Obviously, I mean, when we first hear the word love, we think of sort of romantic, interpersonal love, that sort of love. I mean, that's what, you know, nearly every pop song is written about, you know, chasing or losing that sort of love. It's clearly very, very important. And I think that goes back to the love we feel or the love we had from our parents, we should have had from our parents. I think it's a very deep need for human beings to be loved. I think it's an incredibly deep need to be loved, because I think if we know we're loved, we feel more safe. We feel accepted by whether it's our family, by our tribe, by our group. If we're not loved, then, you know, we could be an outcast, and that could be, you know, in a tribe, that could be very dangerous. So I think there is this need for love. But there's also a whole other side of that, which is the experience of loving, which I think is equally important. The experience of feeling love, of feeling care for other beings, other people around us. And I think that natural state of mind I was talking about, that state of mind, you know, when everything is okay, that state of contentment is also a state of love. It's not the sort of, you know, high, passionate, romantic love. It's a deep, it's got the same quality. It's a very deep, a very still sense of, I would call it lovingness. I think it's what spiritual traditions often call unconditional love. It's love. It's not love towards anything or any being. It's just a quality of love that we notice is just there. It's just, the best way to describe it, just like there is the presence of love. There is the presence of love. We have love in our hearts. And when we have love in our hearts, then as we go out into the world and begin to interact with other people, other creatures, whatever, that lovingness becomes the context out of which we behave, rather than coming from frustration or discontent. We're coming from contentment and lovingness. So to me, they're very closely related, contentment and that lovingness.
What is love?
I think it's that feeling. I think, you know, we all know that feeling. I wouldn't want to define it as a thing. You know, people can say, oh, it's this sort of neurochemistry or something. I just like to go back to the feeling. It's a feeling we all know. It's very hard to put in words. It's a feeling. It seems to be felt in the chest. There's a sense there in the heart area of the body, that feeling. It certainly has a feeling of ease. It has a feeling of okayness about it. It has a feeling of acceptance of oneself, acceptance of another being. It's not judgmental or hurtful. So I would say its primary quality is that sense of okayness, of acceptance, of deep down everything. Deep down, things are okay. Then I don't need to be angry or attacking or judgmental. So I think it's just our natural. It's that natural quality of consciousness.
Yeah, you know, I always looked at well, maybe not always, but I look at as love as the desire for unity, where we want to be part of something. We want to be with something. We want to be united with something, whether it be, you know, I mean, we can love our car, you know, superficially, or we can love a person, or you could love God, or you could love your family, or you know, you want to be with them. It's a desire for unity.
Yeah. I think it is. I think, yeah, you can certainly look at it that way. And I think you could take that even deeper and say, it's also a desire for unity in ourselves, to actually to be complete in ourselves as well, to come back to our true self, our true nature.
Yeah, you see, I agree with that 100%. I look at love, I kind of break it up in my mind in three different chunks. Mm-hmm. And I look at self-love, I look at personal love, where you love, you know, your family and friends, and I look at impersonal love. And mm-hmm. and that's loving mankind, and that's mm-hmm. loving—that's loving the guy that just cut you off on the freeway, right? Mm-hmm. So that's tough. But and not that the other loves are easy, but they're, you know, it comes in kind of lumps that you could say, okay, we first need to understand and love ourselves, and that's kind of a, you know, if we don't do that, and some people don't, you know, you really have a tough time in life if you don't appreciate who you are and what you are. And I think we're trying to learn that, and that's one of the things that we're learning. And then, of course, learning to love others is the same way. And in the end, if you can truly have impersonal love and love all of mankind, then you can really truly function selflessly. And mm-hmm. I think that's a huge goal that we're not really, you know, mankind's not there yet. Our conscious is not there as a group. I mean, maybe individuals.
As a group, I think there are individuals who can certainly live that way as individuals, but it's not. But we're not there collectively. And the fact that individuals can be that way, I think, is what gives me hope. If some other human beings can be that loving and continue that loving, then it gives me hope that we can all do so if we can just learn to recognize what stands in the way of it. Because I feel it's almost like love isn't something we develop so much as we remove the barriers to love.
That could absolutely be. It could be there. And then we've set up some, as you call them, barriers that prevents us, for some reason, from having that feeling, that existence. Yeah,
I think it's the fact, you know, we spend a lot of our time in our thinking minds. You know, probably some of us spend almost our whole time thinking about things, worrying about things, getting excited about things, thinking, did we do the right thing yesterday, whatever it is. We're lost in our thinking mind, and I think that cuts us off from love. And so that's why I think, you know, many spiritual traditions talk about meditation as a way of quietening the mind to come back to that state of ease and contentment, but also back to that lovingness. And again, if you look at, you know, look at a dog, you know, dogs have so much love.
They do.
And I think that's just, you know, they're just, you know, they're bundles of love, most dogs, unless they've been badly treated. And, you know, that's just a natural thing. So, if dogs and other animals have it, I think we have it, but we've lost touch with it. And yeah, that's what's happened with us. We've lost touch with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. You know, another thing I thought is that we live in a cyclic world. Everything, you know, does something and then stops doing it and then does it again. You know, like trees out there, they grow all summer and then they rest in the winter. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the world that we're in. Everything is cyclic. And I'm wondering, as we talk here, do you think that contentment might be our rest period and love might be the period of work where we're working at that? And then while we're working at it, we're seeking contentment at the same time, because we've lost it because we're working at something, and then we go get content and then we're happy, but now we know that we need to work again and work on it.
No, I don't think they're alternate. I see them much more as one and the same thing. I think we do have this alternation, and I think, you know, when we're working on something, when we're out there focused on doing something in the world, there usually isn't contentment there, and I think we're also, you know, not in touch with that love. I think it's, you know, when we do it and we step back and we rest and we, you know, come back to ourselves, then I think we feel the contentment and the love together. To me, they come together rather than alternate.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the social implications of some of those, mm-hmm. some of what we see. You know, it's easy to read the newspapers and get discouraged about the state of mankind. Any thoughts on what's happening in the world and why mankind, how we can turn things around and maybe have a little bit better life for more people?
Oh, you got the big questions, the important ones. And this comes back to, you know, I think what we were talking about, this conditioning we have of looking for happiness out there in the world, what we have or do, and we start seeing other people as somehow being in competition. And it's like, they're going to have what I want, and you know, so therefore I've got to have it and stop them having it. So we start becoming competitive. We think there's a limited number of resources, and there clearly is a limited number of resources, and so people get greedy, thinking the more resources I have, the happier I'll be. In fact, you know, I don't think it does work, because, you know, I've seen the most wealthy people who are far from happy. But where we get greedy, we start wanting to have power for ourselves, we start getting attacking towards other people, we want to put them down. And so it's really, I think ultimately it's part of our search to be happy, to be content, that we start, you know, getting into conflict with other people around us, because we think, you know, in one way or another, they're going to prevent us being content, prevent us being happy. And I think that underlies just about everything. I mean, human greed, I mean, how much of what is going wrong in the world comes back to human greed? I think, you know, an awful lot of it, you know, I want this, I want that, and I'm taking it from you. You know, the huge disparity between the poor people and the wealthy people in this world is, you know, it's almost disgusting.
Right, it's like, staggering.
Yeah, it's awful. But that just comes back to, I think, you know, human beings being trapped in a material consciousness. You know, and there are, you know, on the other side of it, there are some very, you know, wealthy people who are working on just giving it all away, doing all they can to actually really, really help others, which I, you know, totally applaud. So I think, you know, there are people who are changing. But I think so much of it comes back to that. I mean, most, you know, just about every war has been fought over resources of one kind or another. It's like, you know, you're getting my resources, whether it's land resources or oil or water or food, whatever it is. It's fighting over resources because we think, you know, there's a limited supply and I want it so that I can be happy. So I think it comes back to this deep social conditioning we have, that the only way to find happiness is to get enough of the right things or right experiences.
Yeah, materialism clearly has aggravated the human condition as we find ourselves.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. How about egotism? Is that where does that play in all of this?
The ego, yes. Again, we use the word ego in several different ways. I mean, egotism is, I would say egotism is, you know, looking after my own interests without caring about another person's interests. It's putting myself first and not caring about another. And that's really, you know, again, it's another way of what I was just talking about, is say we get egotistical about our lives or our nation or whatever it is we identify with, and I think this is what's important. So I think that's there. But and the ego, we've come back to what we mean by ego. It's really, I think, the ego is this sense of me here in a body needing to fend off the world or take from the world, get what I need from the world, which again at times is very useful. It's, you know, there's times in our lives when we need to be egocentric. If there's, you know, some danger, if we're in trouble, if we're hungry or something, it's very important to be egocentric. But we don't need it most of the time. And what I tend to do is, you know, when I notice that coming up in my life, I just smile and say, thank you for caring. Because I know in a sense the ego is just caring for me. It wants to look after me. It was like, thank you for caring, but right now, you know, you're getting in the way.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, you really, in all of these things, both materialism and egotism and such, you need a balance. You know, one's not terrible. It's when it's out of proportion is when we get in trouble.
Yes, exactly. I think life should be a balance between, you know, going, doing things, as I say, you know, wanting, and there may be discontent then and egotism. And then when things are okay, of being quiet, being content, being in that more loving space. And I would say the balance should be much more in favor of being in that contented, loving state. You know, I would say the ideal balance might be, you know, 80% content, 20% discontent, you know, working on changing the world, making things happen.
Right.
But unfortunately, it's the other way around.
Seems to be. Evolution. Do you buy in? Do you think mankind's evolving?
Slowly. Yes, okay. I do. If we look at humanity, I mean, there's, I mean, you know, we're talking about the state of the world earlier. But in terms of humanity's, you know, atrocities towards other members of the species, you know, there's so much evidence it was much, much, much worse, you know, hundreds of years ago. We're actually getting better. I mean, today, if there's, you know, a murder or someone gets shot or there's, you know, or wars, they make the news. They really make the news because we have a global news service where we become aware of this. But if you look historically, you know, the rate at which people were being killed at other people's, you know, hands, it was much, much worse in the past. So in a way, we're getting better there. I think we are getting more caring. I think we are looking after ourselves much better as well, which is a really important part of this, because, you know, if we're going to become better people, better humanity, then, you know, looking after ourselves, whether it's through, you know, meditation, yoga, spiritual practice, diet, exercise, a whole range of things which we are now seeing is important. And the more healthy we are, both physically, psychologically, spiritually, the better members of society we're going to be. So I think things are changing. It's slow, but they are changing.
Yeah. Any way to speed that up, you think, or is it just, we just have to go along and deal with it as we do?
I actually think it is speeding up.
Do you?
Yeah, I think that's partly because of, you know, the media, which is not just the internet, but books, television. I mean, take yoga, for example, just as one example. There's something like 35 million people in the US doing yoga now. 40, 50 years ago, there was hardly any. It was seen as a very weird thing to do. And, you know, that huge growth has come because, you know, people read about it, they see it on television, they buy DVDs, they can read about it on the internet. So, you know, the media spreads the message. And so, you know, that acceleration, or just the number of spiritual books there are. I mean, when I first got interested in this, there was hardly anything in my local library. Now you find bookstores devoted to this. And all of that is helping people, encouraging to people. So I think it definitely is speeding up. But what more we can do to speed it up? I think two things. One, be responsible for ourselves. You know, it's like, and that's something we can do, which we can enjoy doing. I mean, the more we actually improve the quality of our own life, the more we're going to enjoy that. And the more that's going to sort of rub off on others. I mean, we all know how we feel when we're in the company of somebody who's really, you know, joyful and at ease. It rubs off on us. And conversely, when somebody's, you know, agitated, angry, that, you know, we don't like that so much. So how we are rubs off on each other. But also, I think we can be more positive and just sharing with each other what we find works, what we find really helps us, just to share that with our family, our friends, our neighbors, the people we work with. That's going to encourage it, speed it up.
Yeah, I agree. We're running out of time. This was an incredibly fast interview, but before we leave, I need to ask you, you know, I mean, you're a very popular man for obvious reasons. And would you like to tell the listeners what events are coming up and how they can see and hear you?
Yes. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's a big conference I'm speaking at in San Jose. It's called Science and Non-Duality. That's towards the end of October. If you look up Science and Non-Duality, you'll find that. It's a big conference, very much on spirituality and science. A lot of very well-known people there. Science and Non-Duality. Just look that up. I also have my website, which is full of lots of articles, essays, meditations, audios, and I've got a course at the moment. It's an online audio course called How to Meditate Without Even Trying, which is really helping people take any effort out of meditation, because I think meditation works best when we just allow the mind to completely relax of its own accord. So that's something where they can sort of go to my site, and there's a lot of my material and other
events. I've been on your site, and it's an excellent site.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much, Peter Russell, for coming on our show today. I really appreciate you coming.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
So what can we take away from today's discussion? Science is working on one set of problems, mainly what's the nature of matter and how does the physical world work? When many of us are more interested in another set of problems, mainly why are we here and how should we live our lives? Both problems are interesting, but just understanding this difference helps explain why science doesn't support our spiritual inquiries. But there are scientists like Peter Russell who see the world more clearly and understand that consciousness is the real challenge for science in the coming years, decades, centuries. When science can finally break away from its existing paradigm and accept one which actually includes all phenomena, like consciousness, it will greatly assist mankind's evolution into higher levels of existence. Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and share ideas, the more we will be able to mature our own views. You can contact me through my website at davidgagan.com, and I really hope to hear from you in regards to today's show and ideas for future topics. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. here on W4CY.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You're a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.